Welcome to the show your parents, the PTA, and the asleep don't want you to hear. The Helios Blog. Today, Jordan Peterson and Russell Brand annihilate the woke. This should be good.
The reason she's alone is because she's difficult.
Women are not accepting the bare minimum.
Women fuck men they respect.
All the women who say things like, I'm strong, independent, I don't need no man, like, y'all impress me.
Women just gaslight each other and say what they want to hear.
Is to me sometimes, Jordan, that anthropology and ethnographics suggest that we all live in manageable communities where the kind of narcissism and sadism that you describe cannot thrive because of the way that relationships break down when you encounter personalities of that type.
Right.
There is no ability to regulate a culture at this kind of scale. And I know that what you believe in, it seems at least to me, that you believe in new ways of decentralizing power, both corporate and state. I wonder, are you saying something as significant as the nation project has had its half demi-millennia and that it's time to review even the findings and the treasures of the Westphalian Treaty? Is this a time where we review the way that we organize cultures and society? Because it appears to me that the reason that we have these great gargoyles and demons occupying the public stage, vivid caricatures, vile, lurid and pornographic language, even outside of the erotic, indeed, is precisely because we are living in some outgrowth, in some exaggeration, in some unbearable amplification of the type of systems that we might live by. Industrialization, it seems, ultimately introduced a great deal of tyranny, as well as the miracles it delivered. Agriculture, perhaps the same could be said, but we have no contingency for the problems of scale that have been created by this new type of technology. And it seems to me that unless we introduce real measures, as you say, control mechanisms, that the tyranny now is appearing to be inevitable without significant and organized opposition.
Indeed. Okay,
so one of the things you said at the beginning of that was that when you extract relationships out of their local environment, you lose a regulatory function. You lose an implicit regulatory function. So imagine that, you know, you and I have had multiple opportunities to communicate. And one of the things, and we want to sustain that. So one of the things that we do while we're communicating, we might be trying to make our individual points for our own particular purposes. Hopefully, we're trying to do something like investigate the truth, you know, mutually. But in any case, even if our own personal interests did creep into that, if we had any sense, our exchanges would be bounded by the realization that we're going to interact repeatedly.
Yeah, it's not just a one interaction game. It's a multi-interaction game.
For an indefinite amount of time into the future, right? And so that makes us instantly, the dyad that we form, that makes us instantly into an interacting and iterative community. Now, I believe that it's out of iterative interactions that fundamental morality emerges. And there's plenty of game theory that indicates precisely that. Now,
yeah, that's where the
see what happens to psychopaths and predators and parasites is that they sacrifice the possibility of a long-term relationship for immediate gratification. And that's not good for them, by the way, because they tend to be very unsuccessful people and they have to move from victim to victim very rapidly because people cotton on to their games. But they're not bounded by that necessity of responsible, iterated interaction, you know, the same necessity that would govern you if you were in a long-term committed relationship or the relationship that you have with your children. And it's out of that that morality springs. Now, if you eradicate that necessity, you disinhibit the psychopaths now and the predators and the parasites. Now, here's why this is such a major problem, and it might be a deadly problem. So the biological struggle is an arms race between parasites and hosts, and always has been. And it's such
indeed
a profound race that that's why sex evolved. Sex evolved because there are creatures that replicate, even some lizards that can replicate essentially by cloning themselves. So they produce identical duplicates of themselves. But what happens is the parasites can optimize for their physiology and take them out. So sex mixes genes. Okay, so the reason I'm saying that is because the parasite problem is
so they can escape.
so deep and so profound that sex itself evolved as the method of replication to deal with it. Now, the online communication systems facilitate the parasites, and you don't need that many of them to take a society down. You know, like the real radical types who would rather dance around in the chaos and who are in it only for their immediate self-gratification, they're a very small percentage of the population. Clinical data indicates about 3%. But the problem with that is that if they have free reign, they can take everything down.
If they did
that in the Russian Revolution, for example, this happens.
Do you sense in identity politics a further fetishization of individualism that can no longer really be sustained? That rationalism has brought us to this point where all of our functions tend to be predicated on the service of our preferences and our aversions, that our individual likes and dislikes become our Quran, they become
right.
our religion. And do you feel, Jordan, that partly what you are trying to do is reintroduce transcendent spiritual ideas to a cultural conversation that is bereft in them and is framed only really within the lexicon of materialism and the tropes of post-Enlightenment philosophy that really doesn't embrace mysticism the way that perhaps it could? And within this idea around identity politics and it being a kind of the ultimate celebration of the individual that it has baked into it, kind of is preventative of unity almost in the way that it defines itself. Could you also touch upon this attack perhaps on nature's self, and within that masculinity? I know it's an idea you've talked about extensively, but in relation to identity politics in particular.
Okay, so interesting. It's very interesting, Russell. One of the things that Carl Jung intimated near the end of the Second World War was that the fundamental danger of Protestantism as such was the continual fragmentation of the religious enterprise. And you see this with the multiplication of Protestant sects, let's say. And he thought that the ultimate extension of that would be that each individual, in some sense, would become their own church.
Yeah, which that describes like wokeism like perfectly. Actually, I'd never considered that this womanist wokeist religion is really just an extension of Protestant sects. That's a very interesting concept.
And so when God identifies himself to Moses in Exodus, he says, I am that I am, or I am what I am. He identifies himself as the principle of being and becoming itself. All right. Now, if you identify reality with your subjective experience only, you attribute to yourself that quality. I am the ultimate arbiter of what constitutes reality. But there's a weird twist in that, and it's one that I don't exactly understand, because the subjectivity to which all things are to be subordinated tends to be allied with an extremely narrow hedonism. And so the people who are pushing forward an identity politics seem to identify their own individuality with nothing more, let's say, than their immediate sexual desire. And I would say sexual particularly, because so much of identity politics is about sexual attraction.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you might say, well, it's a pretty strange theory of human existence that you are to be identified with one biological whim, let's say. And so, and the unity that you're describing, I don't even think in some sense is metaphysical or transcendent. I think what it is the hammering into a higher order unity of the plethora of fundamental motivational and emotional systems that would otherwise manifest themselves as a pure local subjectivity. And if that happens, you run into the psychopath problem. Like, if you're only out, let's say you identify yourself with your desires, your immediate desires. Well, then you're going to treat everyone around you and yourself like a means to the gratification of those immediate desires. And what that will do is that'll destroy you in the future, because you're not giving your future self any allowance. You do terrible things now because they're pleasurable, regardless of consequences, and you treat everyone else as if they're lesser and subordinate to your whims. This higher unity, you know, it isn't less real than the subordinate whims. It's more real. Like the hero archetype is the most real representation of the human self. It's the most real. And it's based on the idea of something approximating courageous self-sacrifice. So, for example...
Yeah, exactly. It is masculinity. It's masculinity distilled to its core, right? Sacrifice for the good of the group or of the society, effectively, right? That really is what it is.
You see in the dragon fight story, the notion that you have to confront what you're terrified of and repelled by. You have to do that voluntarily. The more assiduously you pursue that, the bigger the treasure you garner. If you garner the treasure, you're obligated to distribute it generously to the community. And it's all of that that makes up that central archetype of the hero. And that is the central unity, right? That unites the individual internally, unites motivation and emotion, and then unites each individual with the community.
A sense that the hero cannot be mobilized or galvanized without that motivation, that the fuel doesn't arrive until the hero it transcends from egoic motivation to communal motivation. Yes. That when fueled by the ego, you cannot confront the dragon sufficiently. There's a few things that I want to pick up on, and this is this idea, if I may, sir, of utility. That when we see other only in terms of utility, it's obviously restrictive. But I would love to fold into this one of the things you taught us earlier in the conversation: the role of sex in our evolution, and indeed all of evolution, in order to introduce new complexity. If sex has such an epochal role in the evolution of our entire species, surely then it is connected to this consciousness that is ulterior to manifestation and materialization, and therefore its role...
He sounds like a guy that does a lot of mushrooms.
...is almost archetypically significant. I also want to offer you this, if I may, regarding the Cain and Abel analysis. There has to...
After listening to Russell for a while, he just sounds like a guy that just spews the mystical language. Like, kind of like a priest, but like the language he's using is just spiritual as opposed to religious. But... he just sounds like he's full of crap to me. That's just the impression I get. He's fake smart.
To be an ongoing tension between the assertion of our roles as individuals. We have to exist.
Let me know what you think in the comments. But I think he overcomplicates to a fault. So in a way, him and Jordan having a conversation is on the nose.
I have to exist as Russell in the world. I have to know that it is Russell's mouth that I put food into rather than the mouths of others on the most basic biological level. That I am indeed that my entire reality is subjective. That is all I know of reality, and yet I am aware of my insignificance. Somewhere within us, there is some fractal interface between our relative insignificance and our total omnipotence. If not omnipotent, omniscience, that all reality takes place within my
apotheosis
consciousness, yet materially I'm borderline irrelevant. Perhaps there is something of this Cain and Abel tension here. I believe that if people don't have a felt and personal subjective experience of God, whether that's through Christ or the Prophet Muhammad or Buddha, or yogically, some sense of a self beyond self, or some sense of an entity beyond self, some felt experience of knowing that is not about what Russell wants and what Russell doesn't want, then we do become victim to this hedonic ideology that seems to assert itself in the absence of a more deliberate ideology. I've been thinking too of the distinct.
I think it's just more primitive, right? It's just a regression of society and societal ideals, right? Like in a enlightened society, the ideal is the improvement of the society and not the improvement of the self. But as society decays, we go back to our base nature, the meeting of our own basic needs, right? It's a Maslow's hierarchy, but in reverse, as society declines.
Distinction between bliss and ecstasy. Bliss perhaps offers us the idea of fulfillment. Fulfillment. Our cup is full. Ecstasy offers us the idea that my cup runneth over, that boundaries are being burst. This seems to me relevant with your hedonic analysis. So I say that when we strip away God and the possibility of God, then that subjective experience becomes God. That becomes the higher principle around which we organize.
I agree,
so,
actually.
There does need to be some new way of introducing to politics sacredness, the sacrament, the idea, or somehow the representation of this tension, that we are part of the divine, that we have rights, but we are not only our rights, we are also our duties. I know that's not a question, but I also know you'll have things to say.
Well, okay, so there is a gospel injunction as well to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. And you mentioned a reintroduction of the sacred into the political. And what has happened, as you also intimated, is that the sacred has collapsed into the political.
Right.
And that means there are now sacred cows in the political, which is why we can't discuss politics with each other. You need to separate the sacred and the political has to be subordinate to the sacred. I mean, this is one of the most
separation of church
remarkable
and
powerful discoveries of mankind as a whole, is that the principle of political sovereignty has to be subordinate to the principle of sacred sovereignty. And the Christian idea, and this develops out of the Jewish tradition, is that the fundamental principle of sovereignty is, what would you say, is voluntary. It's voluntary. It's a voluntary sacrifice. That's what's at the center of the community, and that the highest is properly devoted to serving the lowest. That's an inversion of the let's say.
I believe I've already commented on this portion of the video, but it's that noblesse oblige, right? When you're of a superior caste, you're supposed to take care of those subordinate to you. You have an obligation to.
The classical notion of power: might makes right if I can crush you. And if might isn't the principle of sovereignty, you have to ask yourself, well, what is? And you could say, well, nothing, in which case you have a kind of nihilistic chaos, and then hedonism rules. And if there's something sovereign above power, then you have to ask yourself what that is. And that is exactly what the biblical corpus, by the way, is trying to sort out. So you see prophets, for example, emerging repetitively in the Old Testament, and they are people who, what would you say, they evince faith that the fundamental structure of reality is good, and that if you live in truth, you can bring about a new reality that's even better. That's the axiom of faith. Then they'll confront, let's say, the tyrant or the catastrophes of the natural world with that banner in hand and revitalize. And the biblical narrative is predicated on the idea that the Christian savior is the ultimate expression of that developing spirit, right? The manifestation of that, the embodied manifestation of that.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Let me know in the comments and the chat. Give this video a thumbs
up. Yep. Okay, and continue.
The orienting response, which is the response that orients you to the emergence of new information in the environment, that grips you. It's like the burning bush. It grips you. And that grip is represented at multiple levels in the nervous system. And that grip occurs on the border between order and chaos.
At this point, it also sounds like mushrooms. It's so needlessly overcomplicated, to the point of it's overly abstract and doesn't even make sense to the most intelligent of observers. Again, let me know what you think in the comments.
Technically speaking, that happens to be the case. You want to be somewhere where you have one foot in order and one foot in the unknown. That's the eternal dragon fight. That way you're stable enough to maintain yourself, but you're also challenging yourself enough to continue to grow and change. Meaning signifies your existence in that place, right? And that's part of the divine order. And I see absolutely no evidence in the relevant neuropsychological literature that any of that is less than biologically accurate. And I know the great literature, Jeffrey Gray's book, The Neuropsychology of Anxiety in particular, and Jaak Panksepp's Affective Neuroscience. And I've talked to many neuroscientists. What's his name now? He's the most cited neuroscientist in the world. He wrote a lot about emotional responses in entropy. I asked him specifically, his name will come to me, whether or not object perception was a micro narrative. And he said, necessarily, yes. You think about that. Every object we see is a prop in a play. At the perceptual level, that shatters empiricism. You don't see facts and objects and attribute to them meaning. You see props in a play. And the question is, well, what play are you playing? What part are you playing? There's no detaching perception from the underlying narrative. It's not technically possible.
Yes, I like that because it's...
Fundamentally, that makes sense, right? It's not... Your perception isn't detached from the narrative. Your perception is the narrative. Perception is reality. Well, who said that? Aristotle? It's like 2,000-year-old idea. It's not something new.
Suggests that consciousness is the prima materia of our reality, that consciousness is the baseline, is the fundamental frequency from which secondary phenomena emerge, that this is genesis, this is the point of origin, this is what precedes that molecular explosion that grants us all reality. Is this the way that you might conduct yourself at the Peterson Academy, bringing together a variety of subjects to create a multidisciplinary education? Would you house debates between yourself and Dickie Dawkins? Would you find me in some cyber corridor, in a mortarboard, in a Hogwarts scarf? Will there be inter-house competitions and Quidditch matches? Would you invite J.K. Rowling so you can be the most controversial in the staff room? What's it going to be like at the Peterson Academy, JP?
Well, I think all of that would be great fun, you know, and as you know, we've invited you to participate. We'll work out the details of that as we move along. What we're doing at the moment is we're trying to find people who are great communicators, who believe fervently in the integrity of their ideas, and then inviting them to produce 8 hours of content pertaining to what they would love to teach most if the restrictions were stripped from them. So, you know, we're trying to produce a diverse...
So what you're describing is universities as they used to be, before they became for-profit businesses.
...range of courses. Our first goal is to produce a Bachelor of Arts for people, an online equivalent to a Bachelor of Arts. I don't think we'll accredit the university because we have to deal with the accrediting agencies, and that's so much of a bureaucratic nightmare that it would be fundamentally counterproductive. But I think we'll be able to guarantee potential employers that our graduates will be accredited in a manner that truly indicates their ability to learn and their disciplined conscientiousness and their potential creativity. So the market value should be there. And we want to walk people through a corpus of courses that will, what would you say, enable them to think more clearly and make them sophisticated players so that if they want to be successful in whatever way they define success, they're going to be armed with the tools that enable them to do that. And we produced a writing app, too, called Essay.app that teaches...
I see. So this is the... What is it? The advertisement portion? I'm going to skip this crap.
It's comical that that's a possibility. But I think it is a possibility. We have great lecturers lined up already. We've taped 20 courses. They're very nicely filmed, very professionally. They'll be delivered at a much higher quality than the typical university lecture. Now, we know that a university isn't just lectures and tests, right? There's a social element to it. You want to meet new peers. Perhaps you want to meet your mate. That's maybe why you're willing to give a university $250,000. And so we're trying to set up a social media platform around it that will enable people to...
Again, this sounds like crap. Sorry, it just sounds like a marketing gimmick to me. This is garbage. Liberal arts, not accredited social media platform. They're just trying to get money. That's all it is. Just another business.
I'd come to lecture, have indicated their interest to repeat the experience. And so we want to bring people together who want to teach, and we want to leave them the hell alone so they can teach. And then we want to offer that to people at as broad a level as possible, as inexpensively as possible, and we'll see. You know, it's a ridiculous...
Okay, still advertisement.
Decentralization and your desire for decentralized models. Professor, please finish.
There are people all over the world that are clamoring for high quality education, not least in the West, but also everywhere else. And the new technologies of translation also may make it possible, at least in principle, to offer what we're offering in a multitude of languages. And, you know, and the translations are very accurate and very high quality. And so, well, we'll see what happens. We're very much looking forward to doing it. We figured the 8-hour format seems to be about right. You know, maybe we'll bundle like 2 8-hour courses together to make a single university credit, something like that.
You see, it's just the business.
But, you know, obviously people can tolerate.
I'm skipping more.
There's no reason not to break that up and to not overwhelm people with, you know, content that would require a devotion of time that they might not be able to manage, especially when you can aggregate courses together anywhere. Anyways, and so 4 2-hour lectures seems to be maybe the sweet spot for the electronic delivery of educational material. We'll see. You know, we launched this Exodus seminar on YouTube, and it's 16 2-hour seminars devoted to an explication of the Exodus story, which was a remarkable thing to participate in, by the way. And people are responding very positively to that, as they did to my series on Genesis. So there's definitely a hunger for high quality educational material. And it's also lovely to be one of the things that's been quite delightful in some ways about no longer being associated with the university, even though there's parts of it I miss, is that when I'm lecturing, I'm only teaching people who actually want to learn. And hopefully this Peterson Academy will be set up that way too. We'll only have teachers who want to teach, and we'll only be teaching students who actually want to learn. So that's an optimized play situation, right? And so hopefully there can be some joy in it and some playfulness. You know, you referred to that as a possibility, and that would be, well, that's the goal.
Okay. Sorry, I tried to skip as much of the ad as possible. I wasn't able to at the end, but hopefully you were patient. So, that's it for this video. Hit the like, hit the sub, hit all for notifications, drop me a donation like Hunter M, Adrian Otto, and Bobby Dylan, Renaissance Press, Brian, Andrew, and Adam. Shout out to you, most recent purchaser of Strategist Guide to Seduction. Thank you. You can buy my books at bit.ly/HeliosBooks. Want to watch my videos in batches of 3 or 4 instead of 1 per day? Cool. I offer early access. Just go to the patreon.com/theHeliosBlog. Want me to help you out? I do also offer coaching services. Just message me at theheliosblog@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys, especially if you listen to the end. I really do appreciate it. Take care of yourselves, and I'll see you next time.